Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of the show, Tutankhamun, the Search for an Egyptian King. The author of the book is with us. She writes on 4 November 1922, laborers employed by Lord Carnarvon and his archaeological partner, Howard Carter, discovered a flight of steps leading down to the lost tomb of the 18th dynasty Egyptian king Tutankhamun. The tomb was virtually intact, and Tutankhamun's mummified body still lay within, protected by a nest of golden coffins and surrounded by a vast array of slightly dusty but still glittering grave goods. This discovery, Egypt's first near-complete royal burial, provoked unprecedented media interest. I guess we could say the interest has never waned. Joyce Tildesley is a lecturer in Egyptology and the KNH Center for Biomedical Egyptology. She has a first-class honors degree in archaeology from Liverpool University and a doctorate from Oxford. She is a fellow of the Manchester Museum and honorary research fellow, as I said, at Liverpool. She's acted as a consultant on several television projects, and she has excavated extensively in Egypt and in Europe. Her previous books include a sequence of popular biographies of Egyptian pharaohs with particular emphasis on the lives of prominent Egyptian women. She lives in Bolton, England, where she joins us by phone today, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for her. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Joyce.
Hi.
Thank you so much for being with us, and what a fascinating book you've written. I want to hear the story of when you were to go see, you were supposed to go to the British Museum to see a major exhibit, and things got a little bit snafu'd along the way, but somehow it must have lodged in your mind that this was a fascinating period in history, and by golly, you were going to spend a lot of your life looking at it.
Yeah, absolutely. It was when I was 12 years old and the Tutankhamun exhibition came to Britain for the first time. And it was just about the time we were all getting colour televisions as well. So there was an awful lot of programmes on the television about Tutankhamun, and we could see everything in gold and beautiful jewel colours. And the whole school decided to go down to London to see it. And in fact, it never happened. We did go down to London, but we couldn't get the tickets to get in to see the exhibition.
Oh.
So we queued up for ages, and then we came back home again. But somehow, you know, the whole idea of Tutankhamun had really taken root in my mind by that stage, and I knew it was something that I really wanted to study.
And why is it that this particular king has stayed in all of our minds? It really informs our knowledge, our interest in Egypt, and our knowledge of the kings and of the pyramids and all of that. When we think of all, we think of King Tut.
We do, and yet he was only on the throne for about 10 years. I think it's because we feel a really strong connection to him, because he's not just a name. We've seen his face, we've seen his property, and we can somehow relate to him. He's quite a young man. And somehow I think we feel we bond with him in a way that some of the other great builders and great warriors, they're very remote from us, I think. Whereas Tutankhamun, we really feel that we know him.
My first encounter with a mummy was the Field Museum in Chicago, and I've got to tell you that it scared the daylights out of me. I had nightmares about mummies for years and years, and I still have a problem with mummies.
You shouldn't be scared of them. The Egyptians themselves didn't mean them to be scary in any way. I think sometimes it's the museums, and we see them kind of standing up, and they look like they're about to walk. But to the Egyptians, the mummy is a very comforting figure because it's a promise of resurrection and the life that's going to come. So you should try and think of them as a comforting being.
Thank you, Joyce. Thank you, Joyce. The next time I go see a mummy, I will definitely look at it with different eyes. All right, let's talk about the gentlemen who were on this mission. And it was a long search before they finally found King Tut. But their personalities are interesting, who the guys were who were digging and digging and digging.
Yes, I mean, everybody was trying to find an undisturbed king in the Valley of the Kings. And everybody more or less realized that the one that was likely to be found was Tutankhamun. because the others either had a tomb that had been found empty or they had a body that had been found. So Tutankhamun, they knew the name, but they didn't have a tomb and they didn't have a body, so that they knew the chances were that he was still in his tomb in the Valley of the Kings. We had a lot of people looking, but the two that found him, Lord Carnarvon was a very rich English man. He'd gone out to Egypt because he'd been ill. He'd had a car crash and he'd got interested in Egyptology and he wanted to dig, but he didn't have the excavation skills. He had the money. So he teamed up with Howard Carter, who had great excavation skills but no money, and the two of them together really inspired each other to search for this king, and they were prepared to spend a lot of time and a lot of money doing that.
You've been on digs before. Tell me how hard it is to find that spot that's going to lead you to the treasures that they found.
I think to find a particular thing like that is very, very difficult. Howard Carter was prepared to strip the Valley of the Kings down to the bedrock if he needed to do it, yes. And that was the only way that he could see that it could possibly be done. Lord Carnarvon started to have doubts after a couple of years because it was becoming expensive. But basically, it's very hard. It's like looking for a needle in a haystack. I mean, today we wouldn't do that. We wouldn't, I think, set out deliberately just to look for a particular grave. We'd be excavating a site and more look to see what turned up in it, if you see what I mean. But for them, it was very important to find this one particular tomb.
And how much did they know about King Tutankhamun? He really wasn't listed on the list of kings, was he?
No. He'd been excluded from the official history of Egypt. So they knew the name because he'd left enough monuments for people to know that he had existed. But they knew nothing about him. And they thought, for example, he might have been quite an old man who'd married into the royal family and taken the throne that way. And that might be why he had a short reign, because he died of old age. And it was only when they found the body that they realized he was a young man, and so he's likely to have been born into the royal family rather than having taken it by marriage or even by warfare.
And what was it that motivated them? What was it, the riches they might find? Was it Egyptian history that fascinated them? Because this required many years and a lot of work. What was the ultimate reward?
Absolutely. I think it becomes a kind of compulsion. I think they knew, they'd seen other tombs, not royal ones, but elite ones, and they'd seen the grave goods that were in there, and I think they were just absolutely fascinated to see what would be buried with the king of Egypt, and this was their one chance. But once they started, they couldn't stop. You know, you get compulsion to carry on doing it, and you think it'll be under the next rock or the next rock and so on, and you can't stop. Unfortunately, they did eventually find it.
And tell me, you include this in the book, of the moment, I think Carter is the one who writes about this, the moment they've discovered something. Can you imagine what that moment must have been for them?
Well, yes, and the thing is, they weren't together. When they actually found the tomb, Carter was there, but Lord Carnarvon was in Britain. So what they had to do, Carter must have been a man of great personal self-restraint and self-control, because he realized he'd found a tomb, and what he did was to actually cover it all up again, put all the dirt back, and then go and telegraph to Lord Carnarvon, and he had to wait for several weeks before he came out to Egypt,
digging
again. So, yes, I mean, extraordinary self-control, really.
And what kind of permission did they need to get to do this kind of work? Did they have to talk to people in Egypt? Did they just go on their own? Was it an elaborate process?
At the time, it was very different to the process we have now. One person at a time could have permission to excavate in the Valley of the Kings, and they had that permission. But they expected that they would be able to keep either all or at least half the grave goods. And after the discovery of Tutankhamun, the whole procedure was tightened up so that these days you need proper permission, you have to have proper workers on your excavation, and you will not be allowed to take anything out of Egypt. Anything that is found will remain in Egypt. And that change in the law actually came about after the discovery of Tutankhamun, because it did seem for a short time as if it might be possible for the finds to actually leave Egypt and come to Britain or go to America, which would have meant splitting them up, and obviously that wouldn't have been a good thing. So the excavation itself actually brought about changes in the law.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome phone calls for you, and we'll take them momentarily. The book really has two parts to it. The whole exploration, the find of the tomb is the first part of the book, and then there's a a big thing about whether or not there's a curse. Those who disturb the tomb are cursed. And so our guest takes on that issue and doesn't believe there's anything to it, but the stories are pretty wild and fascinating. Here is our phone number if you'd like to join the conversation. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. And the book we're talking about with the author is Tutankhamun, The Search for an Egyptian King. Joyce Tilsley is with us. Let's start our phone calls with Hugh in Milwaukee. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. I'm calling two things. One, when I read about King Tut about 50 years ago, I also associate him with a breasted archaeologist who found a hymn to the sun, which is very close to the 104th Psalm. And I've always wondered who borrowed from whom. Was, you know, were the Hebrews influenced by Akhenaten and Tut, or did Akhenaten borrow from the Hebrews? And the second question, 50 years ago, I read that it was Tut was married to the daughter of Akhenaten. And now you, in those days, Tut was not considered the son. Now he's considered the son. Was this just a typical Egyptian marriage of brother-sister?
Joyce.
Hi, okay. Two really interesting questions there. The hymn, the son hymn that you talk about is a fantastic piece of writing, and it does appear to be almost monotheistic in tone. But it's not actually the first Egyptian hymn that's like that. We do have earlier versions, but they are much shorter. So it's very much something that Akhenaten is interested in and he's promoting, but he's not necessarily the first Egyptian to have these ideas. And I think if I had to say where it comes from, I would think that probably what's happening is in the Middle East at this time, this whole idea is circulating and it's being developed in all sorts of different societies. So I wouldn't say necessarily that one influenced the other, but rather that they're probably both drawing on the same tradition.
They did. I'm sorry, Joyce.
Sorry?
No, go ahead, please.
No. Moving on to the marriage of Tutankhamun, yes, it seems definite that he's married to Ankhesenpa Aten, who is the third daughter of Akhenaten. The problem is we don't actually know whose parentage Tutankhamun, whose parents his parents are, because he never tells us. But I think we guess from the fact that he's 8 years old in his when he came to the throne, he's 18 when he dies after a 10-year reign, that he probably is a member of the royal family, because it's very difficult to see how an 8-year-old would otherwise get onto the throne. So we tend to imagine that, yes, he himself is probably a son of Akhenaten, although other people have other ideas, but that is, I think, the main idea at the moment. So, yes, it would be a fairly typical royal marriage between either a brother and a sister, or a half-brother and a half-sister.
And
but you didn't actually have to have that sort of marriage, though. Not all the royal family marriages at this time were brother-sister marriages, but some definitely were.
And how old was he when he would have been married? Would he have been 8 years old? Or?
It's difficult to tell, but yes, it seems as if he wasn't 8 years old, he was 9 or 10. He was married very young. Whether this is, you know, a true marriage in all senses or whether they waited a bit, but definitely the two of them are seen together at the beginning of his reign.
I know you have part of the book that deals with DNA, that we have been able to take his DNA, but for several reasons that you outline, it may not be all that valid.
Yeah, it's very difficult. It's a very interesting science and it's developing all the time. But I know the newspapers would have us believe that everything has been solved, and I don't think it has, because there are such dangers of contamination by sweat and by, you know, other people sort of bending over the bodies, not just modern excavators, but also people in the embalming house and so on. And a hot atmosphere isn't particularly good for DNA. So although we have some evidence that we're kind of using, it doesn't necessarily help us in quite the way that we would hope it would do. We also have evidence from bone analysis as well. But again, we can't be absolutely conclusive and absolutely place Tutankhamun in the royal family, which I think is great, actually, because it makes it all the more exciting. We can all have our own theories.
Right. Thanks, Hugh, for the call. Ken in Oshkosh, hi.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I may have missed it while your screener was talking to me, but just wanted to put in that I thought either in the grave goods or on one of the various stuff around Egypt that Tutankhamun was, they found a form called Tutankhaten, which was why they presumed that he was the son of Akhenaten, who may well have been the first monotheist. And then the question I have for the Egyptologist, in Mesoamerica, the archaeologists have very little problem associating either geophysical or astronomical associations with monument groups. But for some reason in Egypt, despite the placement of the pyramids in the exact alignment of Orion's belt, you folks just will not look at the astronomical association. Why is that?
Okay. Joyce.
Okay, yeah, Tutankhamun. He definitely changes his name. Does that? But we know anyway, we know that he's 8 years old when he comes to the throne, so that he must have lived during the reign of Akhenaten, because that was 8 years before he came to the throne. It doesn't, though, prove who his parentage is. All it proves is that when he was born, he had a different name, and when he came to the throne, he changed his name to take himself away from the Aten religion and more into the old religion again, by stressing his emphasis with the old gods rather than the Aten god. So, yes, it's absolutely true. We do have this different form of his name. But it doesn't really, it's helpful, but not as helpful as we'd like it to be. And looking at the stars,
yes.
That's really, really sort of beyond my capabilities, really, because I know absolutely nothing about astronomy. But I believe some people do it. Obviously, you have to work out where the stars were when the pyramids were built. And, of course, the pyramids are 1,000 years before Tutankhamun. So it's kind of a bit out of my field. But people do look at it. It's just trying to get the agreement of where the stars were at the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, he urges you to take a look at that, Joyce. All right. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Joyce Tilsley is our guest, lecturer in Egyptology at the Center for Biomedical Egyptology, fellow of the Manchester Museum, honorary research fellow at Liverpool University, and author of Tutankhamun, The Search for an Egyptian King. She's joining us by phone today from Bolton, England. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. You can also use the email, that's talk@wpr.org. And you may hear a new voice when the phone is answered. We have a new producer of this program who, along with Rhonda Fanning, who is still with us, we hope for many, many years to come, Brett Jaspers is here, and Brett drove all the way from New York, all the way, halfway across the country to join us in the show. So please give him a warm and hearty Midwest welcome as he answers your phone calls today, and he will be helping out in many ways with this program, along with Rhonda Fanning. So I'm happy. I think it's good. It's all good. Two more phone calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I guess we should explain for those who are new to King Tutankhamun and to this whole story, what these tombs were used for. What was the idea of the tombs in the Valley of the Kings? Joyce.
That's a really interesting question. I mean, you could look at it quite cynically and say a tomb is just to store the body in, but the Egyptians believed that there would be a life after death, so they didn't think that necessarily the spirit would live in that tomb forever. And kings had a very different life after death to ordinary people. They didn't expect their spirit to linger in the tomb. They expected to either go and shine in the star as a star in the sky, or they expected to be in the sun boat that came across the sky every day, or they expected to become one with the god Osiris. So for them, I think the tomb was a place to study, to store their body, and also maybe to store things that would help them to achieve their afterlife. But there's also evidence that they stored things in there that they had used in their lives, and they didn't really want anybody else to get their hands on later. So we have things like baby clothes for Tutankhamun in his tomb as well.
Oh.
But it's a really interesting question, and I don't think it's one that we fully understand exactly what the purpose of the tomb was for. We think we do, but if you think about it, it gets very complicated.
Yeah. And what about being very honest when you enter those tombs? I know that both of the gentlemen had some antiquities in their possession, didn't they? Did they just sort of take a few items from the tomb?
Yeah. I mean, you have to remember that they thought at the time that they would be entitled to take half of what was in the tomb, at least half, if not all of it.
Really?
Yeah, because that was the law at the time. If you made a discovery, things would be split between you. That didn't excuse, of course, disturbing anything from the tomb. They shouldn't have done that. But there's not a great deal of evidence to show that much was taken. It seems that after the tomb had been opened, but before it was fully realized that Tutankhamun was actually inside the tomb, they opened the burial chamber and went and had a look to check that the burial was still intact. They then retreated and excavated the tomb in a normal fashion. And it seems as if a few items might have been extracted then. I'm not quite sure what happened to these items. When Howard Carter died, it was clear that there were some items in his personal collection that probably came from the tomb of Tutankhamun, and they were returned to Egypt. It may be that he took them then, or it may be that Lord Carnarvon had taken them and that Howard Carter then acquired them when he dealt with Lord Carnarvon's collection after his death. Nobody's quite sure of the trail of what happened. Certainly, it's not something that we would approve of in any way these days at all. Nothing should leave Egypt once it's been excavated.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess those are very different times, and they didn't see it as being as bad as we would see it
right.
today.
Right, I understand. Well, look at how enormous this treasure has become. How did the Metropolitan get a hold of some of these pieces?
They just had very small samples. They didn't have anything sort of serious or sort of damaging. But they were very strongly involved in the excavation of the tomb because they supplied some of the experts who actually helped Howard Carter. One of the good things about Howard Carter was that he realized when he found the tomb that he couldn't just work in it by himself. He really needed experts to help him. And a lot of the experts came from the States, and they did things like analyzing samples for him and so on. And so some things did move across. But I don't think there's any question that these were stolen in any way. I think they
right.
were legitimately acquired and then have been returned.
Let's go to Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen. Enjoying the program a lot, as always.
Great.
My question is, and I understand that you are not necessarily an expert on the tombs and the pyramids, but I had heard a few years back of a television program in which the archaeologist involved was saying that there is no evidence that slave labor was ever actually used by the Egyptians to build the pyramids, and in fact, these were considered pretty good jobs by the craftspeople who built them. And I wonder, because obviously this has huge biblical implications, what's your opinion? Were slaves involved in the pyramid building
No, there's no evidence at all that slaves were used to build the pyramids. It seems that they were built by collections of workers who came from Egypt and who were worked at the pyramid site for maybe 4 months and were treated very well. They were given health care, they were given good food, and then they went home again and another batch of workers came in. But, of course, you have to remember that the pyramids are a considerable time before the tombs in the Valley of the Kings. And if you're thinking about, obviously, the biblical archaeology, that is considered anyway to be much later than the building of the pyramids. But even so, there's no real evidence from Egypt for slavery on any major scale at all. They don't seem to have had it, which is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's all voluntary labor. There's the occasional slave, but what they do have, though, they do occasionally take prisoners of war, which might be relevant.
Anything else, Scott?
No, that's great. Thank you ever so much. Appreciate the guests on the show, as always.
Thank great. You. Thanks very much for the call. Can you talk about, because we've become so much in love with King Tut over the years, you early in the book say that it's a paradox that his very popularity threatens to destroy his legacy. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I mean, since we started getting really, really fascinated in King Tutankhamun and going to Egypt and looking at the Valley of the Kings and wanting to visit his tomb, every time we do this and we drive up in a big coach, you know, with fumes coming out of it, and then we go into his tomb and we breathe in there. It's just destructive. It's destructive to the environment, and it's destructive to his tomb. Ideally, from his point of view, it would have been better if he'd never been discovered and his grave goods have been left in the tomb. But now that they have been discovered, we have to find some way of coping with people's desire to see these things and see the tomb, and at the same time to preserve them so that they last for future generations. And it's a difficult problem for the Egyptian authorities.
What do you see when you go to the tomb, Joyce? What's the tour like?
It's not a big tomb at all. And in some ways, it's a bit disappointing because it's not a decorated tomb either, apart from in the burial chamber where it is decorated. But Tutankhamun himself is still within the tomb, and you can see that. And there's something very atmospheric about it, I think. I think a lot of people are touched when they go in there and see him. But to see all the grave goods, you need to be in Cairo and go to the Cairo Museum there. I mean, unfortunately, at the moment, tourism is way down in Egypt because hardly anybody's going there. And the locals are suffering because of this, because so much industry has now been built around tourism.
Mm-hmm.
Which, again, I think we can trace back to Tutankhamun's discovery. I think when it was discovered in 1922, it was just about the point where films were being made and the news was being put into cinemas and so on. It was really the first excavation that was publicized in newspapers. And it sort of took a grip, and it's just carried on from that. And this has sparked tourism in Egypt. And now suddenly, with no tourism going on, or very, very little tourism going on, people are really suffering in Egypt because they've become totally dependent on it.
Right. And what happened at the Cairo Museum after the marches last year? Was it disturbed in any way or not?
Yes, it was sadly slightly disturbed. The gift shop was burnt down, and there was some damage to some of the artifacts in the museum itself. But it could have been a whole lot worse because it's a very centrally situated museum. It's right on Tahrir Square. And in fact, the people grouped together, Muslims and Christians, to actually try and protect the museum from looters and rioters who were taking advantage of the situation. So although there was a bit of damage, on the whole, you know, it's much better than it could have been. I think we're very fortunate.
And what was it like for you who have been studying this? What's it like for you to be in this place, to be at his tomb?
It's fantastic, really.
Is it?
Yes. And strange at the same time because there's all sorts of links going on because you have a link with Howard Carter and Lord Carnarvon, and you imagine them finding the tomb, and then you imagine Tutankhamun himself being placed in the tomb. And it makes it all seem very real, I think. If you read about it in a book, you know about it, but it's only actually when you've experienced the heat and the dust and the sun that it actually becomes totally real to you.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think, anyway.
Mm-hmm. And there is a movement afoot to build a pretend tomb close to the real tomb.
Yeah.
Is that a good idea?
I think so. I think it could be really, really interesting. As long as it can be done well, and I don't see why it shouldn't be done well, it will certainly save the original tomb for future generations to be able to see it. Because if something isn't done, the whole thing will be destroyed. It's just become too popular, and it is small. So if people want to go in, it's either not letting anybody in or letting them into the fake one, which could, to all intents and purposes, look pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think it's a good idea.
Let's go to Bill in Madison. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Would the guest be willing to entertain the possibility that there were many different tribes and many different tongues spoken in Egypt at the time? And that, for example, in the Encyclopedia Britannica, the word pyramid etiology unknown. It may be Finno-Ugric, Pura, Mitta, Pura's wheel and Mitta's measure. Egypt, I, Kapitaya, timekeeper, Tutankhamun, Totta is true, Amun is the morning star, morning god. I could go on and on, but would the guest be willing to entertain that we really don't know what tongue was spoken by the tribe or whatever
mm-hmm.
that Tutankhamun belonged to? And also there may have been these kind of tongues in the Near East as well.
Joyce.
Well, obviously, there were all sorts of languages in the Near East. Egyptian wasn't the main language that was spoken diplomatically. For example, if you wrote to fellow kings, you would write in Akkadian, not in Egyptian. But in Egypt itself, I think I'm pretty sure that there was just Egyptian that was spoken, unless it was a group of people who come into Egypt and then were speaking their own native language. But of course, we're talking about a very, very long history. Again, it's thousands of years long Egyptian history, and obviously the language changes and the ideas behind the language change as the dynastic age progresses. I think it can be quite difficult for us sometimes to realize just what a big time span we're considering here. But we're talking about 3,000 years from the unification of the country till the death of Cleopatra. So obviously there are changes to the language within that. But I think basically the Egyptians themselves speak one language.
There were no significant writings found in the tomb, were there, Joyce?
No, no. Very interesting, because we always hope, or Egyptologists always hope there would be, and they hope that it would explain a great deal, and of course it wasn't found. And some people found that very disappointing, and they thought that the tomb was a disappointment and that it would never really be any use to anybody. But instead, we're now being able to use the artifacts and to analyze them and to use them to understand about ancient life. So we have to work a bit harder. If it's all been written down for us, we could have understood it straight away. But if we, for example, analyze a scene on a box or analyze a garment and see the shape it is, and we can learn Tutankhamun's body shape from that and look at how it's been made, what textiles are used, we can understand more about farming life and so on, we're still able to get a huge amount of information from the tomb itself.
Let's go to Dr. Brian in Wisconsin. Hello, Dr. Brian.
Yes, good morning, Dr. Joyce, Kathleen.
Hi. Morning.
At Wisconsin, I have a couple of things. First thing, and this one's kind of cool, flaky, financially fit friend of mine in Sedona invited me to a discussion by and for Dr. Zahi Hawass back several years ago. During the course of his discussion, my cell phone rang, and guess what? I were cursed.
Guess
but
what?
I didn't talk to you about it.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. Guess what? What?
I were cursed. He gave me the Egyptian mummy, whatever, voodoo, hoodoo, juju curse.
Oh, the curse. All right, let's talk about the curse. Disturbing the tomb.
I think, obviously, people think there was a curse, but the Egyptians, on the whole, wanted people to visit their tombs because they wanted people to leave offerings for the spirit inside the tomb. So they didn't want to discourage people from visiting the tomb, although they weren't keen on people breaking into it and taking things out of it. So you do tend to get a few warnings in non-royal tombs, but you don't actually have curses as such within them. But royal tombs are different. They didn't expect anybody to visit them because they were hidden away at this period in the Valley of the Kings. They were small rock-cut tombs. They're not pyramids. They're cut into the rock, and they're hidden. And the kings expected people who wanted to visit their spirit to go to what we call their mortuary temple or their memorial temple, which would have been a very big temple, very visible on the edge of the desert, near to the people. And people would go to these temples and they would leave offerings for the dead king, even though he was in his tomb, which might be some considerable distance away. So because the kings didn't expect people to go to their tombs, as far as we know, they didn't really leave curses in their tombs to stop people destroying them, because they never really expected that to happen. So it's interesting that we've assumed that there would be curses in the tomb, whereas really there's no real evidence to show that there was any curse within the tomb, other than standard prayers to protect the dead king. But I think we quite like the idea of a curse within the tomb, actually.
Yeah, I think we do, too. We love those stories.
Yeah,
and part
yeah.
One of the chapters, there you got to admit, there have been some fairly strange things that have happened. You may want to start with Carter's Songbird, which is quite a story. Maybe we don't really believe them, but we sure love to hear the stories.
Yeah, I mean, his story is that he brought a songbird to the Valley of the Kings. And the songbird used to sing every day and to inspire the workforce. And then just about the point where the tomb was discovered, the songbird was eaten by a cobra who got into his cage. And
woo!
I wouldn't like that either. The cobra being a snake is obviously, it's a symbol of royalty. So you could see the whole thing as, you know, the king of Egypt sort of coming back to eat this songbird. It's a very odd story, actually, because Howard Carter himself told this story. And yet he's always the one who says that it's absolute rubbish that there's any idea of a curse. So you kind of wonder why he's telling this story if he doesn't believe in there's a curse, because obviously this story fuels speculation that there is a curse. A very strange story, very interesting story. And there are lots of stories, but a lot of them don't have much proof behind them. So
Did Sir Arthur Conan Doyle give us some of those stories too?
Yeah, he was very interested in it. Of course, he believed in elementals and he believed in fairies and he believed in these things. So he was one of the experts that was consulted, because one of the things that happened when the tomb was discovered is that Lord Carnarvon sold the rights to talk about the tomb to the newspaper, The Times of London. So none of the experts who were actually working on the tomb could talk to the press.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, and the press didn't have, they couldn't publish much. They could only publish what they read in the Times. And obviously this caused very bad feeling. But when Lord Carnarvon died unexpectedly, that was a story that they could publish. And they went to experts like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who were experts in the paranormal, and they asked his advice, because they couldn't actually go to the experts who were working in the tomb because they weren't allowed to talk to them. So it kind of fueled itself in a sort of media frenzy.
Oh, that's quite a story.
It's very interesting, one of the first impacts of the media on archaeology.
Huh. Our guest this hour is Joyce Tildesley, lecturer in Egyptology at KNH Center for Biomedical Egyptology. She's a fellow of the Manchester Museum, honorary research fellow at Liverpool University, and author of Tutankhamun, The Search for an Egyptian King. We'll take more phone calls in just a moment. Dr. Brian, thank you for bringing us into the subject of the curse. We'll invite you to join us at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, Reed in Clintonville. Hi, Reed.
Yes, good morning. The previous caller mentioned Zahai Hawass, and I was just wondering if your guest could comment on how he, being his own best publicist, affected Egyptology prior to his ouster, and now how Egyptology may move forward after he's been ousted or removed from office.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. I think obviously some people agree with everything, all the work that Dr. Hawass did. Some people have some issues with some of the work that he did. But I think everybody has agreed that he did a great deal to actually promote Egyptology and also to promote ancient Egypt as a very viable tourist source within Egypt. So obviously I wouldn't want to comment personally on a colleague's work on the radio. But I think that the effect that he's had on Egyptology has been a very good one, in that he's helped Egyptology gain a rightful place, if you like, in the world's understanding of Egypt as an important source of civilization.
You talk about, Joyce, and you have a picture in the book of the golden face, which you say has become for many the defining image of ancient Egypt. Why has it become so? And does it, do you think that we need to dig deeper, that it would behoove us to look at ancient Egypt in other ways and not just keep ourselves to the golden face of King Tut?
Yeah, I think it tells us quite a lot about ourselves, actually. I think there's something in all of us that we really like treasure and we really like gold and we like shiny things. And I think it somehow draws it to us. I think almost in some ways we're more interested in these objects and the consumer aspect of Tutankhamun's tomb than we are in the person himself.
Mm-hmm.
And it is quite interesting that people will always look at the golden mask. They're less keen at looking at the mummy itself or looking at some of the other objects which are less obviously valuable. But it is important, I think, that the style of the art does seem very contemporary to us. It doesn't seem thousands of years old. It seems almost as if it could have been made fairly recently. And this is particularly true of when it was discovered. It fitted in very well with 1920s style art. And it really rang a bell with people again. People started wearing Tutankhamun style clothes and Tutankhamun style makeup and hairstyles and so on, because it really resonated with them. They felt that, again, they could by enjoying these artifacts, they could actually experience something of what Tutankhamun had experienced in his own life.
Mm-hmm. But it's continued to captivate us ever since.
Yes, it has. I think it's, once you become a celebrity, it kind of feeds on itself, doesn't it? He now dominates. I mean, Nefertiti's famous, Akhenaten's famous, Ramesses the Great, Cleopatra. But there are a lot of very, very worthy pharaohs who we completely overlook, and we focus instead on Tutankhamun.
Is it because he died young?
I think that's one of the things. I think when he was discovered, again, 1922, there'd just been a great war, and there'd just been a major influenza epidemic throughout the world. A lot of people had lost loved ones, and I think finding a young man in a tomb, it kind of rang a bell. People could empathize with him in a way that they necessarily don't empathize with Ramesses the Great, who died, obviously, in his 90s and is an old man. I think there was something very poignant about Tutankhamun.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that he had all the gold with him as well just added to the sort of mystery and appeal of it.
Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have some lines open and time left if you'd like to join us. Virginia in Milwaukee. Hi, Virginia.
Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
About 15 years ago, I had occasion to visit Egypt for 5 days, and I stayed with a family in village El Minya. And this is the untourist route, you might say. And although I did go around the pyramids with my host, his name was Shams, and we went around one pyramid, the largest one, on not camels, but horses. And I saw one camel in Egypt. But what I'm calling about here is that we got into one of the museums in Cairo there, and it was packed wall to wall with tourists. Some of them were taking pictures, which, of course, is not allowed, but they were doing it anyway. And I got to see Tutankhamun's tomb there, pretty colossal and impressive. And I wondered later, because I stayed with people who were living in a village in southern Egypt there. I stayed with his family, and they had almost dirt floors. So I thought to myself, people here in the villages have next to nothing, and where is this tourist money going? Well, obviously, it was going to the Mubarak and his group. So I'm just hoping that wherever all of these other antiquities are that came out of Egypt will be brought back so that the people themselves may enjoy them.
Joyce?
Yes. It's very interesting. Actually, I think a lot of people, although it does seem that a lot of the tourist money wasn't going to the ordinary people, I think that now that there are very few tourists there, it's very obvious that a lot of ordinary people are really, really suffering from the shortage of tourists, because so many family businesses are in some way tied up in tourism. The whole industry having collapsed is causing a huge amount of problems. So I think definitely we would all hope anyway that peace returns to Egypt and that things go back to normal and that people can start to enjoy a standard of living again, because it's pretty desperate for people at the moment. If your entire family is dependent on the tourist industry, there's just no income coming in, and it's very, very difficult. The people who are going to Egypt at the moment now, as long as you go when it's safe and to safe areas, it's a fantastic opportunity to see the sites, because there are so few people there. You can be the only person in an archaeological site that normally has thousands of people there.
Are there other excavations going on now, Joyce?
More and more excavations are starting to go back again, and they're starting to work again, or at least to take stock of what's happened while they've been away. I mean, again, it's quite difficult at the moment, but we're hoping that things will get better.
Mm-hmm. And tell me what it is about King Tutankhamun and Egypt that really has fascinated you for a long time. I mean, it's a big deal to write a book about this and to spend a good portion of your life. What is it? Is it the questions? Is it this part of history that you find fascinating? What is it?
I guess it's the fact that I feel I've almost grown up with him. But I mean, we started by saying that when I was a child, I looked so much on the television. So he's always been there. And there are so many questions still. Some of your questioners that your phone people have actually brought out in their questions. we don't know everything. We don't know exactly who his parents are. We don't know exactly who the two little baby girls in the tomb are. So there are still questions to be answered about him. So he might be like the most famous celebrity from ancient Egypt, but yet still he's a mystery to us. And he just deserves further study, I think. You could spend a lifetime looking at the contents of his tomb and still want to do more.
What do you find most interesting in terms of the contents of the tomb?
I think perhaps the clothing, because that was very much ignored at the time the tomb was discovered. Not necessarily deliberately, but because there wasn't really much they could do to preserve it. But now there are teams of archaeologists from Holland working on it, and they're finding some fantastic results. For example, some of his clothing is very colourful, which we don't really imagine the Egyptians wearing very colourful clothes, but Tutankhamun did. Some of it's small size, so it's for a child. Some of it shows that he's got quite wide hips, which is interesting.
He's got what?
Quite wide hips.
Really?
Yes. So he's got quite a sort of thin upper body, but quite wide hips, which I think many of us can relate to. You know, it's all this sort of thing, very, very interesting. And at first sight, you think, oh, well, it's only clothing. What can you learn from it? But actually, the more that people are studying it, the more is becoming revealed to us that we can work out about his life and times.
How does that get preserved for thousands of years, clothing?
Yeah, well, it was just in boxes in the tomb. And some of it, there was a bit of damp in the tomb. It seems that they painted the walls in the burial chamber immediately before they sealed it. So there was damp in there. But a lot of the leather has corroded away and dissolved and gone. But quite a lot of the linen has been preserved. And some of it was quite heavily beaded, so we don't have the linen that the beads were sewn onto, but we do have the beading, if you see what I mean.
Yes, I see what you mean.
Yeah, and it just has. It's a bit random. In patches, it's been very badly preserved and it's been lost, but in other places we actually can reconstruct the garments. So it's fascinating.
It is fascinating. Virginia, thanks for your call. An email that's come in, when you speak to Egyptians, what do they make of Tut's international popularity?
I think they're very, very proud.
Are they?
Yes, yes, yes. Because, I mean, he's one of them, isn't he? And you would be proud if this is your king. And also, I think they're glad because he brings people to Egypt and brings recognition to Egypt. So, yeah, I think a great sense of pride and ownership that all that is many, we are, you know, many, many years later than Tutankhamun, but basically it's still the same country and they're still very proud of their king.
Hmm. So the exhibit that I saw at the Metropolitan many, many years ago, I can't even remember when, where is all of that now?
Was that the original Tutankhamun stuff?
Yes.
That was on tour?
Yes.
It's all back in Cairo. Well, it goes on tour occasionally, but its main home is in Cairo Museum. And they will occasionally send parts of it out to tour. They're not touring the gold mask anymore. In 1972, that toured Britain, for example. They won't send the mask anymore because it's quite fragile.
Oh.
But they will occasionally send part of the collection out for people to see it. But the bulk of it is still displayed in Cairo Museum.
Uh-huh. And that is really the image. That's the image, isn't it? That's it.
Yes, yes.
Why? Why is it that that's it?
I think it's because there's nothing else really like it.
Mm.
And people recognize it. It's instantly recognizable. You just show it to people and people spot it straight away. It's Tutankhamun. They know what it looks like. And again, because of that, they relate to him.
Mm. And tell me, we just have about a little over a minute left. They discover this and all of a sudden the press descends on this story too. Tell me how this story became popularized.
I think it was just at the right time. And it was also, it somehow sparked the public's interest because it's quite a romantic story. But almost from the moment that the tomb was discovered, the press were there. And in fact, it's because the press turned up and the press would also hang out outside the tomb asking for quotes and so on, that Lord Carnarvon did this deal with the Times, as I talked about earlier, to try and restrict the press from getting in. But it wasn't just the press. It was also filmmakers wanted to make films, and at one point Lord Carnarvon himself was going to write a film about the discovery, but it never got filmed. But there were newsreels were shot, and people started to write books almost immediately. So people who'd never actually been into the tomb suddenly started to write books about Tutankhamun just to sort of get in on the popularity of the subject, and it just really exploded.
And Carnarvon died shortly after this, didn't he, after it was discovered?
Yeah, he did. He got an infected mosquito bite and he died.
Uh-oh, what about the curse?
Exactly. That's exactly what people thought, you know, something must have caused this. He was in Egypt because he was ill. That's why he went to Egypt in the first place. He'd had a car crash. But people still felt that it might be because he'd disturbed something that he shouldn't. And this just fueled speculation about the curse even more.
Well, I've really enjoyed talking to you and the book. Thank you so much for being with us. Let us know about your next writing, please.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Joyce Tilsley, a lecturer in Egyptology, and she's at the Center for Biomedical Egyptology, a fellow of the Manchester Museum, and honorary research fellow at Liverpool University. Her book is Tutankhamun, The Search for an Egyptian King. That was fun, wasn't it? Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour. Thanks to Brett Jaspers, first day answering phones for us. He has joined our production here, and we're delighted to have him here. So welcome him, and please listen. More hours to come. Great conversations. Thanks for listening.